Chapter 1, the Constitution, American Independence and Early National Government. The Constitution and the new government it defines did not come into being easily. It took a war with Great Britain, a governing experiment, and a three-year struggle to create a more perfect union. In the 1770s, after a century of British rule in the American colonies, the colonists and Britain's King George III came to an impasse after Parliament passed a series of tax laws. The leaders from the 13 colonies challenged British authority. They were inspired by the philosophers from the Enlightenment who had argued for natural, God-given rights and for a society contract between a democratic government and the people. They argued that if the government violated the understood compact between the state and the governed, then the people would take that power back. After a successful military campaign, the leader American revolutionaries became the founding fathers of the new nation. After a failed attempt to govern themselves during the 1780s under the Articles of Confederation, a stronger framework, the Constitution, became necessary for the United States to transition from a loose collection of souvenir states into a unified republic. The Road to Revolution. Britain's King George III and Parliament passed laws that restricted the colonies' freedom and taxed them to help finance the Crown's empire. With plentiful land and resources, the North American colonies were among Britain's most financially successful properties in under West financially challenged time. Decades of war and imperial endeavors have ravaged the British treasury. The British Empire controlled colonies throughout the world, and maintaining such a fair-flung empire required revenue. The Sugar Act was Britain's first attempt at increasing revenue. Soon, the snapback, which taxed colonists who transited legal documents, the Tea Act and other acts followed. The colonies organized to oppose the acts. Some colonies opposed the tax on a practical economic basis, but most outspoken American leaders took a principled position against the laws because Parliament created these without any colonial representation. No colonists expected the democratic representation Americans value today. At the time, only white men with property would cast voters in English and American elections. But colonists felt that Crown's complete disregard in any representation to violate the Enlightenment philosophies they so revered. No taxation without representation, demanded the colonists. The British government responded unapologetically and declared the colonists were virtually represented. They reminded colonists that the most citizens reading Parliament insists that they still consider the colonists' best interests. Tensions increased as protesters refused to abide by the new laws and the British government doubled down to enforce them. Royal courts tried and speech, free assembly, and free press by exacting punishment when colonists spoke, gathered, or published in opposition. The colonial leaders attempted at first to negotiate a peaceful relationship through the olive branch petition to King George, a symbolic act of peace in which they pledged loyalty but also made clear their grievances. The king rejected the petition and the colonists mobilized for a revolt. Influence of Enlightenment thought. The Sons of Liberty and other advocates for freedom drew an Enlightenment political theory. It had been developed with the principles of rationalism that had unlocked doors to the natural world during the scientific revolution were applied to the social world as well. Especially influential were the writings of English philosopher John Locke, 1632-1704, and Swiss-born philosopher John Cahes Rousseau, 1712-1778. John Locke and natural law. Locke argued that natural law is the law of God and that it is law acknowledged through human sense and reason. He proposed that under natural law in a state of nature, people were born free and equal according to this law. Locke reasoned, no one can be subject to the political power of another without his own consent. Locke argued further that natural law not only entitled but obligated people to rebel when the rule of kings did not respect the consent of the governed. Jean Jacques Rousseau and the social contract. Rousseau was much influenced by Locke. He spoke for those intending their minds away from irrational or arbitrary political order, away from a governmental theory that restricted the divine rights of kings and clergy to rule and misrule. The opening sentence of his influence in financial treatise, The Social Contract, dramatically lays out a key human problem. Man was born free and he is everywhere in chains. The Social Contract, Rousseau, describes his agreement of free and equal people to abandon certain natural rights in order to find secure protections for society and to find freedom in a single body politic committed to the general good. He envisioned popular sovereignty, the people as the ultimate ruling authority, and the government of officials to carry out the laws. French philosopher Montesquieu, 1689-1755, like Rousseau, recognized both the sovereignty and the administrative aspects of government power. He argued for the separation of powers in the administration of government comprised of the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. Enlightenment thought he was well known among English colonists in North America. According to the historian Carl Becker,
Most Americans have Azor Locke's work as a kind of political gossip. The American revolutionaries believed that men were entitled to life, liberty, and property, and that these cannot be taken away except under laws created through the consent of the governed. These beliefs formed the bedrock of the political ideology known as republicanism. The lack of colonial representation in parliament, taxation without consent, and subsequent infringements of liberty violated fundamental rights and the values of republicanism and would, in time, be remedied by an independent, limited, and representative government based on ideas of natural rights, public sovereignty, republicanism, and social contract. Three kings of representative democracies. Representative democracies based on the values of republicanism can take at least three forms. Participatory democracy. This form of democracy depends on the direct participation of many, if not most, people in society, not only in government, but in public life as well. In the participatory democracy, people voted directly for laws and other matters that affect them instead of voting for people to represent their interests. The democracy in 5th century Athens were participatory, though only adult male citizens could vote. Most recently, a group of college students in 1960 stated a government and participatory democracy, protesting wars abroad and inequality at home. They formed Students for a Democracy Society. In 1962, some of the members met in Port Huron, Michigan. They modeled participatory decision-making as they collaboratively drafted their beliefs in the Port Huron Statement. This document calls for the direct involvement of ordinary citizens, especially through civil disobedience. One of the founders of the organization and drafter of the statement, Tom Hayden, explained years later that the concept arose in response to observed limitations of an undocumented system that we saw as representing an obfuscating, a system in which a small number of people hold most of the power. In the 21st century, participants in the company Wall Street movement, which spread to many locations in the United States, partly through social media, sharing campout financial districts to protest wealth inequality, the corporate influence on government and the political occupation. Occupy Wall Street designed itself along the guidelines of participatory democracy, using a bottom-up rather than top-down approach to formalizing policy, encouraging other members to participate in both person and on social media. However, in the participatory nature, make decision-making difficult and slow, and action agendas hard to develop. A number of states use a form of participatory democracy when citizens who gather sufficient signatures place issues on the ballot for the people to decide. 26 states allow some form of ballot measures. On election day 2016, some of the issues voters were deciding through ballot measures related to gun control, the death penalty, and the minimum wage and bilingual education. Pluralist democracy. In a pluralist democracy, non-governmental groups organize to try to exert influence on political decision-making. Ancient groups, as these groups were called, such as organized labor unions or gun advocates, are one of the most influential types of groups. They interact with government officials searching for consents among competing interests. They raise and spend money in elections to ensure that people friendly to their ideas are elected. These groups send professional researchers and experts to testify in congressional committees hearing in hopes of shaping or stopping a bill. They monitor the government as it enforces existing law, and they buy as the primates and other media products to influence public opinion. Pluralist theorists believe that the ideas of the viewpoints in the United States are so scattered and so varied that so single view can control the shaping and administration of policy. We live in a world of so many policymakers putting into effect so many rules and procedures at local, state, and federal levels that no single input shapes our body of law. We are a nation of immigrants, both ethnically and ideology, diverse, and the large variety of viewpoints result in the public policy that is usually established and accepted by consensus. Elite democracy. In an elite democracy, elected representation make decisions and act as trustees for the people who elected them. Elite democracy recognizes inequality and the spread of power among the populace, and that the elite's people with resource and influence dominate. Dominating influence by the elites, the trade of the United States when it was founded, weakened somewhat in the progressive era, 1890 to 1920, when the masses became more involved in politics. Yet in many ways, elite dominated politics prevail today. Individuals with the most time, education, money, and access to the government will take more action than the less privileged, and because of this resources, they will be heard. People who serve in the leadership of a political party, whether on the local or national level, or usually of the higher socioeconomic level, better known and better educated than the rank and file, the many members of the group who constitute the group's body.
Declaring independence. Before Americans knew exactly what their representative democracy would look like, American-British tension rose to new heights. By the summer of 1776, the Continental Congress commissioned a committee of five men, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston, to draft an official statement to summarize the colonists' views. In the document, which became the Declaration of Independence, these men justified the break from Britain and proclaimed to the world the reason for independence. The declaration, signed on July 4, 1776, created a moral and legal justification for the rebellion. During the war, Americans instituted the Continental Congress to govern the American states collectively, and they began to formalize ideas for a permanent government. The war raged on until General George Washington's army defeated the British at Yorktown, Virginia in 1781. An official peace was negotiated in 1783 with the Treaty of Paris. The Articles of Confederation. As soon as the states declared independence, they realized a more formal relationship among them could not only assist their cause. The Continental Congress created a committee of 13 men to draft the Articles of Confederation, a series of statements that defined the international national government and redefined the former colonies as state. Through the Articles of Confederation were not officially ratified by the states until 1781. The Continental Congress legislated during wartime with a wide area of powers to adopt commercial codes, establish and maintain an army, define crimes against the United States, and negotiate foreign affairs abroad. This document defined the firm league of friendship that existed among the states, which had delegated a few powers to the national government. How to appropriate states' representation in the newly designed Confederation Congress was the best one.
Some leaders recognized the merit of giving greater representation to the more populated states, something the Virginia delegation advocated. Leaders from smaller states opposed representation based on the population. After a furious debate, the Articles of Confederation created an equal representation system. Each state received one vote in Congress.
The Confederation Congress continued to meet in New York. State's appointed delegation upon seven men that voted as a unit. National legislation required the voters of at least nine states to pass. A unanimous vote was required to alter or amend the Articles of Confederation. The Articles entitled the Congress to engage in international diplomacy, declare war, and inquire territory. They provide protection of religion and speech. They provide for extradition. They had committed crimes and runaway slaves to states that had fled. The document encouraged a free flow of commercials among the states. It required that states provide a public fair government and the Congress could sit as a court in dispute between states.
Shays' rebellion in response. The lack of centralized military power became a serious problem when a regional rebellion broke out. In the western Massachusetts in 1786, a large group of improvised farmers, including many Revolutionary War veterans, lost their farms to mortgage, foreclosure, and failure to pay taxes. Daniel Shays, a former captain in the Continental Army, led the group who demanded that the government ease financial pressure by printing more money, lightening taxes, and suspending mortgage. They grabbed their muskets and challenged the Massachusetts government. The Massachusetts raised a small army with donations from the wealthy centralizing in an attempt to put down the uprising. But without a centralized military power, the Confederation could not muster a national army. Several skirmishes occurred, and three of Shays' men were killed. The movement soon collapsed, but Shays' rebellion, along with irregularities in the commercial, made leaders realize the need of revised government. A small group convened in Annapolis, Maryland, to discuss the concerns. This convention addressed trade and untapped economic potential of the new United States. Little was accomplished, however, except to secure a recommendation for Congress to call a more comprehensive convention. Congress scheduled the much larger convention for May of 1787 in Philadelphia. By then, a few Americans viewed the Articles of Confederation as sufficient. John Adams, who was serving in Congress, argued that a man's country was still in his state, and for his Massachusetts delegation, the Congress was our embassy. There was little sense of national unity. Debate and compromise at the Constitutional Convention. The Confederation Congress called the Conventional in Philadelphia for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. By the time the process war was over, critics pointed to the extraneous matter outside the law in which the Articles were instead completely replaced by a new system of government. In May 1787, delegates from neighboring states began to arrive in Independence Hall in the Pennsylvania State House to get an early start on improvising national governance. Among the first to arrive was 30-year-old Virginia lawyer James Madison, and he was well prepared for this the liberation. His friend Thomas Hitchin was serving in Paris as the U.S. ambassador to France, and he sent medicine books from Europe on ancient governments, both successful and failed examples. Though Madison was not the most vocal in the convention, he kept detailed records of the conventional, including debate speeches and the votes of delegates present. His influence in creating the plan for the new government and his stalwart support of it during the modification process earned him the nickname Father of the Constitution. Other noteworthy delegates include George Washington, who served as a cooling force during the heat debate. In fact, Washington's participation alone evaluated the validity of the meeting and devoured it to enhance government. Another influential founder, Alexander Hamilton, Washington's aide de camp during the war, proved annoying at the meetings for his long-winded speeches. Benjamin Franklin, the elder statesman at age 81, offers his experience as one who participated in the drafting Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation themselves, and the Treaty of Paris with Britain. He also had distinction in discovering invention and civic endeavors. In addition to these leading statements, others in attendance included representatives with significant experience in public affairs, some of whom would become future Supreme Court justices, cabinet members, and notable congressmen. Nearly three-fourths of the delegates had served in the Continental Congress. Several had helped draft their states' constitutions. 8 has also signed the Declaration of Independence. 21 have fought in the Revolutionary War. As soon as the quorum enough presents to conduct business of 7 states arrived, the convention established some basic ground rules. The delegates unanimously elected George Washington, the most revered man in the room, as president of the convention. All delegates had an opportunity to speak uninterrupted, but then had to wait for another delegate's responding before speaking again. States would vote as units, and simply a majority would carry each state's vote. Perhaps the most controversial rule was that those attending the convention had to keep everything secret during the proceeding until the entire plan was ready to present to the public. The controversy and intense viewpoints had the potential to incite exaggerated rumors. Opponents of the convention would feed on any information or misfortune to dismantle this plan. To protect convention proceeding, and despite the heat and annoyance of flies, the delegates kept the windows closed and proceeding quiet for the duration of the convention. The Virginia Plan. Numerous plans were presented to the convention to improve the working of the national government. Virginia's governor in Budden, Randolph, introduced what he later dubbed the Virginia Plan. Written largely by Madison, the plan created a three-branch system of government defined by 15 resolves and called for the national executive to administrate the business of a state judiciary and a bicameral or two-house legislature. The people who elect a lower house that would then elect members of the upper house. This plan became the blueprint for the Constitution. The Virginia Plan was also made the national government supreme over the states and offered the ideas of for a multi-year court system and the separation of powers, defining the distance, responsibilities, and limits of each branch to keep any one branch from becoming too powerful. Delegates discussed and intensely debated the plan as the smaller states began to fear the overwhelming precipitation larger states would have. The New Jersey Plan. William Patterson of New Jersey introduced a counterproposal for government. The New Jersey Plan, as it came to be known, different from Randolph's proposal in important ways. It assured that states would retain sovereignty. It proposed that the national legislature would have only limited and defined powers. It included no provision of national courts. Two other distinct differences between Patterson's plan and the Virginia plan and how representation would be appropriate and whether or not the new government would be federal. A collection of sovereign states gathered to govern, or national, a unified authority with absolute sovereignty over the entire nation as well as individual states. The Great Compromise. Representation had been the frustration of the Americans since they began seeking independence. The more populated states believed they deserved a stronger voice in the making national policy decisions. The smaller states sought to retain an equal footing. The matter was referred to a committee made up of one delegate from each of the states represented at the convention. A committee that became known as the Great Committee. George Madison, William Patterson, and Benjamin Franklin were among those on the committee. And Roger Sherman of Connecticut joined the committee, taking place of Oliver Ellsworth, who became ill. He took the lead in forging a compromise that became known as the Great Compromise, or the Connecticut Compromise. Sherman proposed to create a two-house Congress composed of a House of Representatives and a Senate. His plan satisfied both those wanting population as criteria for awarding seats in the legislative, because House seats would be awarded based on population, and those wanting equal representation became the Senate, because the Senate would receive two senators from each state regardless of the state size. Slavery and the Three-Fifths Compromise. Another compromise would be necessary before the question of representation was settled. However, delegates from the non-slave states question how slaves will be counted in determining representation. Since slaves did not have the right to vote, those who were able to vote in the slave states would have more sway than voters in non-slave states if slaves were counted in the population. Roger Sherman once put forward a compromise, this time with Pennsylvania delegates James Wilson. They introduced, and the convention accepted, the Three-Fifths Compromise. The Northern and Southern delegates agreed to court only three of every five states to determine representation in the House. Two other issues regarding slavery were also debated that then addressed in the Constitution. Although the words slave and slavery did not appear in the document, delegates questioned whether the states of the federal government should have the power to control or regulate slavery. They also debated how to handle slaves, insurance, or runaways. Delegates resolved the first matter by prohibiting Congress from stopping the international slave trade for 20 years after ratification of the Constitution. They resolved the second debate and with an extradition clause that addressed how states should handle runaway slaves. Other compromise would be necessary during the summer-long convention in Philadelphia. For example, delegates debated whether or not the United States needed a president, a chief executive, and how such an officer should be elected. Some argued that the president should be elected by members of Congress. Others argued for the election of the president to be done by the state's governors or state legislators. And some thought the people themselves should directly elect the president. The Electoral College was the compromise solution. Under this plan, states would decide how their electors would be chosen. Each state would have the same number of electors that they have representatives in Congress, and other people will vote for the electors. Having electors rather than a popular vote choose the president represents one way in which the elite modern democracy helps shape government today. Still, other compromises were needed to resolve what powers the federal government would have and what powers the states would retain. This debate went back to debates where the Articles of Confederation were drafted. The delegates who desired stronger states' rights and feared a nationalized centralism of power wanted a limited list of powers granted to the national government. They wanted a confederal system, a loose collection of sovereign states gathered for a common purpose. They varied relationship defined under the Articles of Confederation. A national government, however, would make the national lawmaking body supreme and create a strong union instead of a loose collection of states. Delegates who considered what types of laws the Congress would make and what citizens' rights to protect. What resulting from a bundle of compromise was the U.S. Constitution. The table and then Constitution. Once the plan for national government was complete, the proposed constitution contained seven articles with a host of provisions. The document opens with a preamble, a sort of mission statement that begins with "We the people" and outlines the purpose of the new government, such as establishing justice and providing for a common defense. The plan for government included three separate branches, legislative, executive, and judicial, each having a unique power and each able to block the other from gaining too much power. It included an executive president to serve as commander-in-chief and a Congress that could tax, borrow, and regulate commerce. It also called for a Supreme Court and a plan to create lower courts and the Electoral College system to elect this president. Policy, how government business gets done. The plan the farmers created included a complex and competitive policy-making process to assure that the people will and would be well represented and freedom would be maintained. Policy means the laws the government creates and the manner in which they are carried out. Under the Farmers' Plan, Congress, as the most representative branch, writes and passes most laws. Those laws constitute the chief beliefs of the United States. The president and his or her administrative agencies, however, carry out and enforce those laws. There might be a leeway or room for interpretation, and different presidents will carry out the law with different methods. For example, the policy of marijuana held by the administration of President Barack Obama 2009 to 2017 differed from the president of President George W. Bush 2001 to 2009. Bush administration raided a California cannabis dispensary even after medical marijuana had been legalized in the state. That raid resulted in a conviction later upheld by the Supreme Court.
A few years later, President Obama's Attorney General signaled an easing of federal enforcement in states where the people held a voted to legalize marijuana. The administration of President Donald Trump supported the use of medical marijuana, but in the early 2018 ended a policy that provided legal shelter for business selling marijuana for recreational use in states where recreational marijuana had been legalized. In another example, the way in which a president and the State Department interact with other countries and treaties the United States enters help define foreign policy. Indeed, some of the agency in the executive branch, such as Food and Drug Administration or the Environmental Protection Agency, have authority to create and shape industry regulations. And of course, when the Supreme Court interprets law and sets new precedents, it redefines what government can or cannot do, making law anew and shaping policy. Ratification. When the farmers finished the final draft of the Constitution, not all were present in the Independence Hall. As most remaining men attached their names to the document, three stood by and refused to sign it. Edmund Randolph was one. He had watched as the convention altered the Virginia plan he introduced in May. George Mason, the chief author of Virginia's Declaration of Rights, was another. He refused to sign because the Constitution had no federal Bill of Rights. The Constitution lacks of a detailed list of rights became the national debate over the following year. Finally, Massachusetts delegate Elbridge Gerry did not agree to the new plan. The delegates departed Philadelphia wondering what the future held and if their months of work, debate, and detailed plans were for naught. Leaders and citizens fell into two camps, those for and those against the new plan. Support for the Constitution. With the insistence of the fellow pro-Constitution Virginians, Madison named himself a candidate for the state's ratifying convention to hold in Richmond. From New York, he began writing a series of essays for publication to argue in favor of the new plan. He soon joined fellow delegate Alexander Hamilton and New York Governor John Jay in writing a series of essays that explained the framers' intentions. These authors, writing under the pen name Pluvis, published the Federalists to assure citizens that they had created a federal system and the states had not lost their importance. Today, these essays are called the Federalist Papers. The so-called Federalists also wanted to allay fears that the plan would subject people in the states to abuse by this new national government. Opposition to the Constitution. Opponents of the Constitution, including Virginia's Patrick Henry and George Mason, desired a federal government more like the other one under the Articles. Madison and his colleagues attaching the Federalist name to their cause prevented opponents from claiming the label. Opponents then became known as anti-federalists for the lack of better term. The irony was that the anti-federalists argued for a truly federal government as defined, while the Federalists advocated a national system with some loss of the state sovereignty. The anti-federalist concern came from the recent experience with an autocratic ruling country. Some feared a single executive might replicate a monarchy king, potentially limiting state and individual rights. Congress' power to tax, to control a standing army, and to do anything else they felt necessary and proper made the anti-federalists worry. The thick veil of secrecy in which designing men had conspired to draft the document made anti-federalists and much of the general public suspicious. Newspaper published the text of the Constitution in essays for and against it, such as the Federalist Papers and the Articles by Brutus, giving citizens of the newly independent nation the opportunity to read and digest views for and against the ratification of the Constitution. Some state conventions had remarkably close votes, but the Federalists won the day. With New Hampshire becoming the ninth state to ratify, yet most agreed that without New York and Virginia, the new republic might stumble. Most of these states did ratify, but only after the continuous debate and close votes, and after nine states had already ratified, the government under the new constitution was underway for 1789. Congress began
meeting and President Washington took office. North Carolina and then Rhode Island ratified, resulting in the ratification by all 13 states. A Bill of Rights. George Mason's concern was that the original Constitution had no Bill of Rights disturbed many others as well. Those who fought for independence argued that the Bill of Rights was necessary to secure the liberties earned through the Revolution. The document framed in Philadelphia lacked a guarantee of free speech in Congress. There was no protections against aggressive persecution and no promises against cruel and unusual punishment. The Constitution did not, however, include a few basic rules. The Anti-Federalist and some pro-Constitution leaders believed a list of rights were needed to complete the Philadelphia mission. There was opposition, however. One leading opponent was James Madison. He called Bill of Rights parchment berries, mere paper blocks of injustice and tyranny that could prevail if the government itself did not have provision to prevent such tyranny. He offered as examples minorities who had suffered at the will of majorities and states that did not, in fact, have bills of rights. He also believed that by listing all the rights the federal government could not take away, and right could be inadvertently overlooked and the new federal government could later take it away. He believed the Constitution never entitled the new federal government to take away any rights in the first place, so why was it necessary to list those that could not be taken away in the future? The debate for or against adding a Bill of Rights overlapped a series of ratifying conventions that occurred throughout 1787 through 1790. With the efforts of the Federalists as well as assurance, the amendments protecting personal rights will be added the large later states ratified and joined in Union. Additionally, as the new Congress began meeting in the 1789 delegates petitioned for these rights, Madison and the Congress compiled the many concerns into the amendments that became the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was fully ratified by 1791. The Bill of Rights included many essential rights, most of which were violated under the oppressive British regime. The First Amendment declares freedom of religion, speech, press, and peaceable assembly, and the right to petition the government. Congress and the people put a high priority on the rights to express political ideas, even if unpopular. Other amendments protect private property, due process, and fair trials, and prevent cruel and unusual punishment. The Tenth Amendment prevents the federal government from taking any power that are reserved to the states.
Policy Matters, Individual Rights in September 11. Like states' rights, the individual rights guaranteed by the Bill of Rights have sometimes seemed in conflict with federal law. Knowing where individual rights end and the government authority begins has been the subject of many legal cases and will be covered in depth in Unit 3. One vivid example here, surveillance resulting from the federal government's response to the 9/11-2001 terrorist attack that killed nearly 3,000 Americans brought down the towering World Trade Center, which illuminates a key conditional issue about democracy and the government's power. Government surveillance following 9/11 and its response to it show how multiple political process actors and institutions create solutions to address concerns of citizens.
Not long after Al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked four U.S. commercial aircraft to fly them into selected targets in New York and Washington, President George W. Bush addressed a joint session of Congress stating, "Whether we bring our enemies to justice or bring justice to our enemies, justice will be done." Faced with an adversary that generally operated underground and not under the flag of any sovereign nation, the United States modified its laws and defense operations to create a series of federal policies to counter threats. These policies fueled an ongoing debate about proper recognition of the Bill of Rights. Constitutional principles. The framers included several governing principles. They ensured a level of democracy by maintaining elections for members of Congress and the President. Yet instead of creating a democracy, the Constitution created a representative republic that limits government and tempers hasty, even in popular ideas. Further, the framers called for a separation of powers, with each of the three branches responsible for different governmental functions. The separation of powers and the provision of how laws are made and enact establish a system of checks and balances that prevents one branch from becoming too powerful. Under the federalism, the national and state government divided and shall share power as well through the principle of national supremacy gives the federal government the power to decide the supreme law of the land. The Constitution flexibility has empowered the government to face unforeseen circumstances. A democratic republic. The framers wanted the citizens' representation of democracy, but at national level, they created a representative republic, a collection of sovereign states gathered
for the national interest, national needs, and the national defense. To promote popular sovereignty, the farmers require popular elections every 2 years for the House members, but those who were the only popular elections they put in the original Constitution. State legislatures elected their senators until 1913. The state named their electors to the Electoral College, and then the Electoral College elects the president.
Separation of powers. The framers made the legislative, executive, and judicial branches distinct in their own powers and responsibilities to dilate power among the three branches. Earlier in school, you might have learned that the legislator makes the laws, the executive branch enforces the law, and the judicial branch interprets the laws. This simplification overlooks the fact that all three branches can establish law and policy, but it does highlight the basic functions of each branch. The legislative is the most numerous and representative branch, and the ultimate makes the public will become public policy. The power of Congress are further separated between the two chambers. Neither house can pay a house into law without the consent of the other chamber. The president is ultimately the authority to enforce the law and carry out Congress policy. So the president and his administration shape policy in doing so. Members of the Supreme Court and the federal courts appointed by the president and the approval by the Senate hear disputes and interprets laws and their application.
Balances. The limiting powers each branch can use of the other is known as checks and balances. They are especially clear in the lawmaking process. A bill, a proposed law, can originate in either the House or Senate and must pass both bodies with a simple majority, 50% plus one. Then the bill is presented to the president, who may sign it into law if he agrees with the proposal. Or the exercising executive checks and balances, the president may reject it with a veto. If after 10 days, excluding Sundays, the president have done neither, the bill becomes law. If the president receives a bill at the end of the legislative session, however, refuses to sign, is known as a pocket veto and kills the bill. After the president consents to a law, it is entered into the United States Code, our body of federal statutes. If the president vetoes a bill, the Congress, each house acting separately, can reverse the veto with a two-thirds override, requiring a two-thirds superior majority vote in each house. The framers place additional checks on power, such as impeachment process and the Senate's right to provide, achieve, and consent formal approval on the presidential appointments. And each impeachment is an accusation and intimectic of wrongdoing. Article 1, Section 2 claims the House shall have the sole power of impeachment and can impeach the president, a federal judge, or another official of wrongdoing. The Senate then holds a trial for the accused official. The Chief Justice presides as the judge. If the president is on trial, the Senate must vote by two-thirds majority to find an official guilty or not guilty. The system of checks and balances, including impeachment, is based on the rule of law.
Two presidents have been impeached, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton,
for abuse of office and accusation of lying under oath. After each trial, the Senate did not remove each president because the charges did not reach the standard for treason, bribery, or other high crimes of misdemeanors. The framers gave the president the right to appoint by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, ambassadors, other public ministers, and consult judge of the Supreme Court. The president appoints the cabinet, secretaries of state, and defenses, for example, judges and heads of agencies. Senators will suggest appointments, and the Senate must approve any appointments the president makes. The federal courts have leverage against the other two branches when they interpret the law or apply it or refuse it to apply it. Courts can deem an act of legislation unconstitutional when deciding on a case, a process known as judicial review. Federalism and interstate relations. Federalism, the balance of power among essential national authority and state or regional authorities, assure a limited government. Assigning different powers to the federal and the state governments have been a vital issue at the Constitutional Convention. Congress and the president have unique powers defining their responsibilities and limits. The states have denied certain powers, and the 10th Amendment ensures that the states have delegated to the federal government only those powers listed in the document. All other powers are reserved to the states. Flexibility. Limiting government was important, but the framers had the foresight to ensure flexibility. These men have seen much change in the generation and suspected that unforeseen events and changes in society may require revolutionary changes in national policy and in the Constitution. That's why they include the necessary and proper clause and the amendment process. The first allows Congress to legislate on matters closely related to the express powers. The amendment process has allowed for the Bill of Rights, woman suffrage, a redefined presidency, and national income taxes, among other changes. National supremacy. To avoid the lack of unification experience under the Articles of Confederation and to unite the national under stronger national policy, Article 4 was included to establish national supremacy, the authority of the federal government to be the supreme law of the land. The anti-federalists heavily questioned the provision. A clue to assure compliance with the acts of Congress and treaties with other nations, the supremacy clause has placed the national government in some respect above the states in areas of large delegate to the federal government. For example, in coining or printing money, international diplomacy, or national defense, the federal government is exclusive authority, yet Congress cannot claim national supremacy on distinctly reserved powers. The three branches in practice. The legislative, executive, and judicial branches operate mostly in the nation's capital and remain busy creating and refining national policy. A busy and diverse Congress, a president and his large administration, and a court system stretch across the land are all part of the policy-making process. Legislative. Congress operates in Capitol Hill, where 435 House representatives and 100 senators make the nation's laws, determine how to fund government, and shape the nation's foreign policy. On opposite sides of the Capitol, the House and Senate operate in separation chambers and with the different rules of procedure. Citizens elect these officials periodically and can contact them to express their views or to favor or oppose a bill. Congress members have an official near the Capitol and multiple offices in their home districts. The two senators from each state represent a state at large and have staggered terms. The two houses have different age requirements, 25 years old for representatives and 30 for senators. The age difference, the size and scope of each body, and the number of citizens each represents create a unique dynamic in each house. To carry out their duties, legislators in both houses have staffers, legislative research aides, and the communication chief. They have a budget to run their office, free use to the mail, free travel back and forth to their home states. Experienced members have the areas of expertise in lawmaking, perhaps based on their careers before becoming a politician on a subject of law that is dear to them. Both the House and Senate have an array of committees, usually between 10 and 30 members of each, that oversee certain topics of law or policy making. Congress has thousands of employees that write the bills, gather research data, take the pulse of citizens in each district, and let the voters know about all the good things their Congress member has done, especially near election time. In addition to contacting their legislators, citizens can gain understanding of proposed bills through the Congressional Research Service through the Library of Congress, where they can read synopsis of bills. Also, the media reports on and analyze proposed laws and critique laws after they take an effect. The House Senate are aired live on C-SPAN television. Executive. Article 2 lays out the requirements for office and executive role. The president must be 35 years old, a national-born citizen, and resident of the United States for at least 14 years. The president serves a 4-year term and, since passage of the 22nd Amendment, can serve only 2 full terms. The presidency has grown in both scope and power. President George Washington had a 4-person cabinet and no more than few hundred government employees. Today, the cabinet has grown to about 20 members, and the federal executive branch has more than 2.7 million employees to carry out the nation's laws today. The president's immediate staff in the West Wing of the White House advise the executive daily and provides the chief link to the other institution of government and to public.
entire office of aides shape the president's message and connects with Congress at the safe staff level. Large executive branch departments and agencies oversee entire wings of the government, such as military, and govern entire national industries, such as the Federal Communication Commission, which regulates radio and television broadcasts and internet communication. Institutions below the presidents are part of the bureaucratic machinery that carries out the law or the defense of the United States. Congress creates these entities, checks on the performances, determines their funding, and occasionally reshapes their mission. Congressional committees keep an eye on them. Some agency exists to protect citizens who can file a complaint to assure enforcement or the fairness in law. For example, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission investigates compliments of discrimination in the workplace. Of course, citizens can report federal crimes to the FBI or the Drug Enforcement Administration. And a voter can find where a federal candidate's donations come from at the Federal Election Commission's website. Judicial review has often become a major step in determining and sometimes in finalizing law. The Supreme Court and lower courts have exercised judicial review to protect liberties and property initiate policy. Courts can use this power to check the legislative, the executive, or the state actions ordered to shape overall policy in the United States. Citizens have often found the federal courts the place to challenge unfair government action, to appeal wrongful convictions, and to question actions of schools and state governments. Because of the citizens' lawsuits in these courts, Americans can now say and print unpopular and even anti-government ideas, challenge convictions made in unfair trials, and attend equal schools without limitations based on race, and marry whom they want regardless of gender. The Supreme Court is where such national policies have established. At least 5 of the 9 justices who serve today must agree on a majority opinion for a decision to uphold or overturn law. Members who agree with the majority opinion but have differing or additional reasons for researching that conclusion can issue concurring opinions. Justices who disagree with the majority opinion issue dissenting opinions. As with concurring opinions, justices can dissent from the majority opinion from different reasons, so there may be several dissenting opinions. Through this book, you will encounter the must-known decisions, those landmark Supreme Court calls that will likely be the basis of questions on the AP government and politics exam.